This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 31st of December, 1956. The title of this lecture is Confrontingness. This lecture is 64 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
It's quite remarkable that the dianazine is being sold here, we suddenly have discovered, has been played on the safe side. And we've got to have it re-altered because a very mild and innocuous form of nicotinic has been used in it by the chemist at a tremendous sacrifice to his own future bank account. This simply means that it does have that niacinamide, evidently. And it is actually nothing more, as far as you're concerned, than a guck bomb. See, its guck is all right, but it's not up on its nicotinic. Now, I have to advise you that in order to get this stuff to wallop, this particular unit, this particular batch, you'll have to take 200 to 300 more milligrams of nicotinic acid, usually the Abbott nicotinic. It doesn't cost too much to get this stuff to jolt and to get it to work. The formula of dianazine properly prepared consists of the old guck formula, which is B1 dicalcium phosphate and ascorbic acid. Those three things must be taken together, evidently. Otherwise, some bad imbalances result. And they are taken together in more or less this ratio. More or less this ratio. Anywhere from 25 to 50 milligrams of B1. Let us call it 50 milligrams of B1. 20 grains of dicalcium phosphate with or without ergosterol, with or without vitamin D radiation. Works perfectly fine with it. And that is the usual way to buy it. But it's dicalcium phosphate, not calcium gluconate or some other such form of calcium. It's dicalcium phosphate. As I say, about 20 grains. Ascorbic acid, anywhere from 250 to 500 milligrams. Any of those are perfectly admissible dosages. And to that can be added about 15 grains of iron in the form of ferrous gluconate or colloidal iron. Of course, if you took colloidal iron, it'd take much less quantity, but about 15 of these ferrous glutinates, 15 grains. That's pretty heavy, but it's evidently needful. And nicotinic acid, old style, as sold by Abbott. Old nicotinic acid, 300 milligrams. This is taken in one dose once per day. Additional dosages do not particularly add to a series or add to the results. Now, it has been taken, this bomb, it has been taken just as nicotinic acid only. Nicotinic acid only. Without any really bad effects. It seems to work a little faster if the old guck bomb is thrown in with it. But don't take B1 without taking dicalcium phosphate. Don't take dicalcium phosphate without taking ascorbate. These three go together as a trio. And any company which is selling any one of these without selling the other two is actually asking for difficulties in their clientele. They do not know too much about vitamins. Our work on this subject is probably very original, which has been going on since about 1950. But the boys have taken anywhere from 300 to 1,100 milligrams of nicotinic acid, old type, per day, once per day, and achieved good results. And they have also taken it at the rate of 500 an hour without killing themselves off. They've taken it at the rate of 100 an hour. They take it in various ways. The lethal dose of that is way, way, way up there. I don't know what it is. Somebody told me one time it's about 90 grains, some fantastic amount. I don't know what it is. And I don't think they had that correct either, because I didn't see them killing anybody just to find out, and I'm a great believer in proof. So, in a pinch, low on cash or supplies, you can achieve a good result by using nicotinic acid only, dosing at 300 to 500, all in one dose, once per day, before or after meals, it doesn't matter. It turns on its effects in about 5 minutes, and they usually continue for about 50 minutes. And that's that. They may get a slight headache or a residual or something of the sort, or a little nausea and so on. Well, you could get anxious about it and take some more. You could do that, and it would run it the rest of the way out. But usually the best way to do is just skip it and take some more tomorrow. Immaterial. Immaterial. Lots of extra vitamins have been tested without any change of any character. It is discovered that after a while, somebody pumping himself full of nicotinic acid only, that he runs down a bit on his B1 or something. He starts having nightmares or something. So it's not very serious. Not very serious. Ferrous sulfate is not as digestible as ferrous glutenate, and it takes more of it. You probably have to go up to about 30 grains of ferrous sulfate, evidently. This is all hit or miss, all of this vitamin dosage, because the experiments have been done on chickens. You can't find out much about a human being by dosing up chickens. But the complete essential is that if you take B1, it is evidently vital that dicalcium phosphate and ascorbic acid are taken as well, more or less in that ratio. You might say 50 milligrams of B1 requires at least 250 milligrams of ascorbic, requires at least 20 grains of dicalcium phosphate, usually with ergosterol. That's a triangle that they go together. They interact on human beings. I don't know how they act on chickens. All of our work, you see, is based on human reaction, and therefore some of our figures differ. But nicotinic is usually best taken with that trio I just named, and it can be taken total independence. And where old style nicotinic is used, you get a reaction, and where there's new style, which is an entirely different drug evidently, you don't anywhere near get the same reaction. And so I give you the data that we have on the subject. How long should this course be continued? Actually, it should be continued until one no longer gets a severe kickback. When one no longer gets a kickback, he's all set. This is not a cure for a cold, but it itself will turn on a peculiar kind of cold occasionally. The manifestations which it turns on are low order prickliness of the skin, heat, feel hot and flushed, and turn on patterns of old sunburns and exposures, turn on x-ray areas where you've been x-rayed, you'll feel that. All of these things are additive to the number of allowable rentgen. I love that, allowable rentgen. I didn't allow any of it. And you get these various manifestations, but they die right on down. The only real danger there is in taking the stuff is that you will take it a short distance, scare yourself half to death, and not take any more. Leave yourself stuck at that particular point. The way out is the way through with this as with auditing. It is not a supplement. It's not a substitute for auditing. It doesn't even vaguely do the things auditing can do. But it is a rather broad therapy on this. And you take that existing tablets, making sure that you have a couple of hundred at least extra shots of nicotinic acid, and you'll be doing backflips, okay? All right, I thought you might want to know a little bit more about this, since this was called a Radiation Congress. Might interest you that many aspects which are called hay fever are probably turned on by the small amount of nicotinic acid that is contained in pollen, cigarettes, and so on, which just start to run a somatic. It's probable that lung cancer is caused by cigarettes because there isn't enough nicotinic in a cigarette. There is just enough to irritate and start the somatic running. Now, I'm not trying to tell you we've wrapped up cancer. So the tiny amount of nicotinic that is in pollen and in other substances, including cigarettes, could turn on a little bit of this somatic. And that would be hay fever. Now, in view of the fact that at certain seasons of the year, dust is radiated by sunlight, we would get everything present to make a very, very nasty case of sinusitis, hay fever, or allergy. We have nicotinic starting to run out, radiated dust. There we go. That's all you need to get good and sick. Now, the answer to that would be to start a course of 300 to 500 milligrams of nicotinic per day, once a day, all at once, and you would find out that this manifestation shifted rapidly. I'm not trying to tell you we have a cure for cancer. If it cures cancer, all right. If it doesn't cure cancer, all right. The evidence is in favor that it does, but I won't say that it does. You see, the data which I give you is based upon observation. It's a little bit different. And if I haven't seen something, I won't tell you so. The code of ethics of Scientology are much different than those of the drug companies. For instance, heavy courses of biochemical antibiotics, heavy courses of penicillin, oreomycin, chloromycetin, probably cause anemia and probably aid and abet cancer and probably really put the whip to radiation poisoning. They're very probably some of the more dangerous things which are kicking around today, since they spoil the body's immunity. And yet they're handed out by the gallon jug load. You could take a little bit of oreomycin and not have any balance the rest of your life if it's an overdose. Chloromycetin can cause anemia. So it's an interesting world, this world of drugs, isn't it? Well, I've seen these things happen, and so I tell you, I'm not just being critical, telling you about antibiotics. What is the answer to being well? Well, a total answer to being well is to be able to have a body. That's the answer to being well. And the rest of the answer could be said to be capable of permitting the body to confront things and being yourself capable of confronting these same things so that you have atomic fission, radiation. These things are the result of flinch. These things are the result of back away. Nobody can get trapped unless you make him flinch. You put him in a trap and you say, ha, you can't get out. He says, He flinches. Otherwise, just in a relaxed state, he'd sail through the trap. He wouldn't even know it was there. Unless he had a good tolerance for solidities. If he had a very good tolerance for solidities, that was very interesting. If his tolerance for solidities was very, very good, he'd unmark a section of wall, move his body out through that, and mark the wall up again. I point out to you that this is not an optimum situation, and police don't like this. In fact, I've heard it said that Scientology freed people. It actually is on a route to freeing people all the way. But what course would you proceed upon if you're going to audit somebody who had a very, very specific illness? Well, today you could proceed on almost any course which led to his confronting it. You could proceed on any course which led to his ability returned to confront it. Now, if a man knows all about an illness which he has, and if he's an authority on that illness, and he still has the illness, you can be very sure that his information is in error. If he could confront that illness, he wouldn't have it. I'm afraid that's the case. An ally can only continue to aberrate somebody because that somebody uses a mechanism to permit him to continue to confront the ally after the ally has departed. And what part of the ally does he continue to confront? Unfortunately, the part of the ally that he never confronted. In other words, the ally carries on. He has some willingness to continue to confront Grandma. But Grandma was the one who had a certain cough. And his effort to confront Grandma brings no reaction beyond the cough. He can have the cough. He can't have Grandma. He wants to confront Grandma some more. He has the cough. Well, he couldn't ever have been confronting the cough. He must have been confronting Grandma. Because if he really bluntly confronted the cough, he'd have to keep mocking it up to keep it there. Otherwise, it wouldn't continue. Let's look this over a little bit more. You find this interesting? We have in the mind, several oddities. And one of these oddities is the oddity of valence. By valence, we mean a personality or a beingness. assumed knowingly or unknowingly. And when that valence is assumed, the individual manifests the characteristics of the valence. This is so true that if you can ask by straight wire a lucky question, you can cure almost any psychosomatic. We used to do this in Dianetics, but it was too hit or miss. We can still do it, but it's too hit or miss. There were many people who never got the knack at all, because it's a knack. Fellas going, he said, "Who used to cough like that?" "Oh," I said. "Come on, who used to cough like that? Did you ever know anybody cough like that?" And he says, "Yeah, Grandpa." Okay. That was the end of that cough. Guy didn't cough anymore. One straight wire question. Boom. How'd this happen? That's because you ask him to confront the cough at its source. Second, he did that. It wasn't. Because he was unknowingly holding on to Grandpa's cough. Unknowingly holding on to it. And you, by your straight wire question, got him to knowingly confront it. The second he did, it wasn't. But he had to remember this with considerable clarity and brilliance. One of the more interesting conditions which I observed one time was a skin cancer on somebody's nose. It was pretty well advanced. And I asked this person, "Have you ever known anybody that had any trouble with the skin on his nose?" "Yep." Person after a little while said, "Yes, yes, my father." I said, "Would your father worry about it?" "Yes, he worried about it all the time." "Well, did your father ever talk to you about it or something like that?" "No, no, but I used to see him standing in front of the mirror examining it." Piece of confrontingness. Now, I said, "Do you remember the exact time and place?" "Yes." And 3 minutes later, the person had no skin cancer. Very spectacular, huh? We had a case one time, a person had a goiter about the size of a small basketball. It was pretty exaggerated. And somebody was running an engram, and the person ran across an ally that had a goiter just like that. And within a half an hour, the thing receded and disappeared without a mark. Miracle cures. Now, we've seen these from time to time, things like this. We've seen a miracle cure. Well, why did we have to keep on calling them miracle cures? Because we didn't quite know what happened. We knew the right question, but we didn't know exactly why it worked. We got the person to confront the source or the true ownership of the difficulty. And that's why it worked. Next person didn't work, but we found out something very interesting with it here very recently. On the skin cancer case, if we'd asked this person, "Who had this?" He said, "Father." Then we said, "Well, did you ever see your father do this?" "Yes, I remember a time seeing your father," and the skin cancer didn't disappear. Doesn't mean the technique didn't work. It means that we weren't far enough south. That's all. We just weren't far enough south. The person was never able to confront father. And there's where we should have started in. What of fathers could you confront? And we would get the same miracle cure. We did spot the person who had the difficulty, you see. But the person not only could not confront the difficulty, but couldn't confront the owner of the difficulty. And so, we would get no release of the circumstance at all. It was necessary that we get the preclear to confront the owner of the difficulty. Now, there's gradient scales, where gradient scales come in. You say, where, and what of this owner could this person confront? Well, maybe he could confront father's shoelaces, or confront father's cigarette ashes, or confront father's hat. but not father. Will we start in on a gradient scale and start working it up the line? Tell me something of your father's that you wouldn't mind confronting. Maybe we go clear out to his boyhood, which the preclear never shared. And eventually we would get up to the preclear confronting father, and then we would get the cessation of the skin cancer. See? The only reason these miracle cures worked is because they were set up. The person was already willing to confront that person, but hadn't ever noticed that he was unwilling to confront the illness. And the one factor of the person that was not confronted persists in the preclear, and that is the law behind this. That which is not admired tends to persist. That which is not confronted tends to persist. Tells you nobody's looked at this universe lately. All right, so we have a little girl. And this little girl goes out and plays with another little girl. And this other little girl does some peculiar things. And little girl A that we have comes home and starts doing these peculiar things. Do you realize that it doesn't do you a bit of good in changing the child's behavior to tell the child not to do that anymore? Because it has already exceeded the ability of the child to confront, or the child wouldn't be doing them. Think of that for a moment. Think of this in terms of punishment and behavior. The child was unwilling to confront these bad habits or behavior patterns in this other child. And being unwilling acquired the habits. And then you come along and you say, you mustn't do that, which means you mustn't confront that. And you make it obsessive. I would hate to tell you how to break the bank for every cigarette company in the world. Is just insist children smoke. They won't smoke anymore. Now that's the way it goes. You're going to make a good world out of this, huh? Where the only things that persist are the bad habits of others. Well, fortunately, there's a great deal of knowingness, and fortunately, there's a great deal of thinkingness, and fortunately, there's a great deal of ethic and ability and imagination in every human being. And that ability keeps the more obsessive and unconfronted things under control. But every now and then, somebody discourages people. Somebody comes along and says, there isn't any reason for you to be good, and there's no purpose in life anyhow, and it's all blah, and so forth. And you shouldn't do anything for people. You know, you're really, the only reason that you're contributing to the livingness of others as Scientologists and Dianeticists is because you're obsessed with the whole idea that you must help out. They're being critical because contributing to is too far upscale for them to even get any idea of it. Follow me? People aren't helping other people because it's propitiative. To be propitiative in helping others would mean that your help of others would be unknowing. And helping others on an unknowing basis would probably wind up in surgery or something. Or an outright understanding that you had no slightest idea of helping anybody and became terribly obsessed with the idea of fraud and swindle on the part of every group that could heal. Because you yourself were a swindle. You see how this could be? Every once in a while, an auditor begins to wonder, am I auditing preclears just because I am crazy myself or something of the sort? Now, am I auditing preclears merely because so and so? Well, as a matter of fact, back in book one, we said one of the ingredients of an auditor was courage. You guys that audit people have got nerve. You got more nerve than the rest of the race. That's for true. I'm not trying to flatter you. Or we pull somebody in off the street and we tell him to audit somebody else and he just shatters. He doesn't just protest, he just shatters. The idea of confronting somebody else's mind or engrams is so far beyond his capabilities that he's liable to tell you, well, God made him that way and he's supposed to stay that way. In other words, he's way down at the bottom scale. Training today is really something. Training is rough, but it's also gentle. We don't teach new processes anymore in the academy. We don't. We teach processes that you have heard about over a long period of time. Processes, some of which are 4 or 5 years old. Training's been very stable for many, many, many months. Why is it this stable? That's because we found out that if a person can do these techniques, he can do anything. And so we've picked out those techniques which a person has to be able to do. And then we can give him any technique, and he can run it. And what is our training level at? It's leveled at encouraging his ability to confront these phenomena in others and himself. And he becomes aware of them, and he becomes capable of confronting them, and he becomes a good auditor. But the people who come to us to be made auditors and to study auditing are far superior to the people who are walking down the boulevard. I hate to tell you this, because it sounds like gross flattery. We're probably dealing across the world with the top 10,000 human beings. You say, gee, I know what horrible shape I'm in. What kind of shape are they in? Well, they have the blessings of being unaware of it. The blessing of being unaware of something is like saying he is in the happy state of having his head in a boiling pot. No, what we do today in training is, with all the things we have learned, and there are tremendous numbers of things, leading a person forward and raising his ability to confront. We take the least of these techniques, and we take the average person, bring them into class, go and teach them how to audit. I mean very average people. And as I say, they just shatter. Go all to pieces. They're sitting there and they go through some kind of rote procedure and then all of a sudden realize that they're being asked to confront something and they just blow up. They might just blow up by pining away. But they can't do it. They don't want to know anybody else has a mind. They don't want to know any mechanism there. They think this would be a terrible thing to know. They think there's some reason why they should be buried. They think there is some good understanding back of all of this that is superior to theirs, and therefore they should continue along in a state of unawareness. They've been created. You start moving even these people upscale, however, and they can get to up to a point where they must be contributed to. And you can work with them a little bit further, and you find out that you can move them up to the fact that they don't mind people looking at them. In fact, they insist on people looking at them as they walk down the street. They must be confronted. And we audit them a little bit further, and we find out, they start telling us, all the times they've been had, they're the victim. We audit them a little bit further, and they can waste and substitute and waste, and the first thing you know, they can have something, a scrap of dust, but they can really have it. That's an odd thing, have it. That isn't yet confronted. That is an ability to possess, to own, and not mind it too much. The next thing you know, as you audit him, this pre-clear, in having this, he finds out something very strange. That it is enough to have it sit out there to feel that he could possess it. What's that that you've run into? That is confrontingness. He is moving up toward space. And unless a person can be moved up that high in a tolerance of space, he is a dead duck in the face of atomic fission. Two X-ray particles, or waves, as the fashion may be, would knock him off. His liability to the existing amount of strontium-90, Einstein-60, is way low. He's unaware of it. Something's troubling him. Something is burning him up. One day he's standing there, charred cinder. What hit him? He read an article in the Saturday Evening Post about atomic fission. That's all it required. That is all it required. Just an article. Just enough to re-stimulate the bank a little bit. And he's caved in. If this person heard that such a thing as dianazine would turn on a somatic, he'd run like mad. He'd say it was poison, just like they say. Get the same reaction. The ability to confront is the ability to have space. You have to have space in order to have a universe. And space is freedom. And therefore, if one is to be free, one must be able to confront. The man who is running away from the enemy is never afterwards free. Whether we call it guilt, whether we call it cowardice, whatever we call it, he is never afterwards free. He would be freer if he were stone dead as a body. He who fights and runs away lives to resist the draft another day. That's not quite fair, because fighting and being drafted are not the same thing. I feel for these poor guys that get drafted. Thinking of getting up obsessively on the subject of having to confront sergeants all the time. Now look, if this means so much, if this very thing called freedom depends upon confronting us, we'd certainly better know quite a bit about it. If the ability to handle, to control, to have, to use, to expend beingness, livingness, depends upon such things as I've read to you from this list, havingness, confrontingness, and so forth, then we better know a lot about it. And we do know a lot about it. I dare say we will know a lot more about it one of these days. But I can tell you right now, it isn't necessarily true that this must be followed to get a person into a frame of mind that he cannot confront. But how does a person ordinarily get into the frame of mind that he feels he can't confront things? Not, by the way, by making up his mind that he can't. He has assumed a pattern already on the earlier track, the motto of which is enough to confront. He must have enough to confront. If he doesn't have enough to confront, he doesn't have. And the whole thing comes down to what it says there in Scientology 8008008 on the subject of abundance in all things. Easiest way to remedy confrontingness is to have the individual mock up things to confront. In other words, he gets less and less things to confront, and after a while he figures out that he can't confront them. Naturally, that's true. He can't confront a podium that isn't sitting there. But he says, after a while, in order to confront a podium, it must be sitting there. And that is not correct. That is reaction. That is the motto of the reactive mind. And that's where reactiveness comes from. It must be sitting there for me to confront it. If it isn't sitting there, I can't confront it. Therefore, it must follow that I am afraid to confront it. Therefore, I must forget all about it. And it is quantitative at that level of the scale. And all you had to do is remedy the number of things he could have or confront, and you've got it. Enough to confront, that's all. If you had a bunch of soldiers, and they never fought a battle, They would after a while become cowards. Not because they were cowards, but because they didn't have any enemies to confront. And they figure after a while that they must not be able to confront an enemy because they're not confronting any enemies. And therefore they're not good soldiers. And they buy big walnut mahogany desks. They figure out after a while they're yellow. I wouldn't keep a group of soldiers idle. I need to disband them and let them go confront families and businesses and life. You could cave a whole country in by keeping a bunch of soldiers out of war. The only other thing you could possibly do is say the Republicans have an army and the Democrats have an army and they fight every Tuesday. And the side that wins gets its bill passed. This is the way you'd go about it, I'm afraid, silly as it sounds. If you're going to have an army, use it. If you're going to have a tank force, for heaven's sakes, at least let them chew up a forest once in a while. Crash, crash, slam, bang. Keep them on the move. If you're going to have a navy, at least have some of them dub in as pirates to be caught. Otherwise, you're going to have a navy that sooner or later will turn on its own government. Why? It couldn't possibly turn any other way. It couldn't fight an enemy. One fine day, you have a revolution, like the German Revolution. Do you know what happened in Germany? You know how World War I ended? Very few people do know. They were retreating. The army was retreating and retreating and retreating. But they were still fighting and they were still loyal. But there was an organization sitting in port which had not fired a shot since the Battle of Jutland, if I remember rightly, the Grand Fleet. And the German Grand Fleet had been sitting in harbor, doing nothing, confronting nobody, on and on and on. The army was retreating. The army already realized it couldn't totally confront the enemy, but they were still pretty loyal. And all of a sudden, the Navy mutinied. Why? They hadn't even been in the war. And they mutinied and set an example, and some of the troops in the army were also infected. And the next thing you know, Germany overthrew itself with its own troops. Russia, 1 year before, had already done so. They wouldn't give the Tsar's soldiers rifles with which to fight. They appointed some archduke as munitions buyer, and he bought mistresses. In other words, there was lots of rifles to be bought, but he just found some other use for the money. And Russia went on fighting Germany, quote unquote, with the first rank of the squad with rifles and the second rank to pick them up when the first rank got shot. And they couldn't then confront the German army. And they, after a while, said, well, we're not able to confront the enemy. We're soldiers, we must be able to confront something. So they went and killed the Tsar. People fall down scale in what they're willing to confront. And when you set a terrific goal for people to confront, the next thing they do, if they fail, is to find something less to confront. It's a very dangerous thing to have an idle set of troops around. Very, very dangerous. They get upset, disloyal. And one day you call on them and they aren't there. Of course, it takes years and years and years for it to happen. You can have a war every 15 or 20 years and still keep the army from caving in. But don't try to have a war once every 100 years or 75 years. The military long since would have overthrown everything. There's nothing to confront. They're supposed to confront something. What am I supposed to confront? Well, there's nothing to confront because war is evil. Well, if war is evil, why have an army? Now, one of the more interesting facets of military behavior is actually explained in this confrontingness. Troops that are merely kept on maneuvers and kept up pretty high and kept exercised and so forth, do all right. But if you let them sit around in the fortress long enough, wow. For a long time, for instance, the Air Force, then the Army Air Corps, weren't permitted to fly. And their state of discipline and uniform and everything else went to pieces. It just collapsed. Nobody appropriated enough gasoline for them. They didn't have enough airplanes. Man, they really had something to clean up there after a while. Why? Just because these boys were supposed to fly and nobody let them confront the air. You get the idea? All right, so you take this person who is capable of doing various things, and then you say, precaution, precaution, safety, safety, restraint, restraint, mustn't, mustn't. And after a while, he's just going to say, I'm Yella. This body's too valuable. I can't control it. I can't move it around. I can't do anything with it. I'm sick. Maybe the whole society starts saying that, but they start saying it in unison, and nobody notices that they didn't used to all say this in unison. And the world ends with a whimper, not with a bang. See how it could go? Bodies are made to be used, not necessarily fought with. You do things with them. If you're brought up to a tremendous state of training in any particular direction, and then you're never permitted to exercise that skill, you'll find out eventually you feel you can't do it. Picked up painter. Young painter. He'd been quite successful illustrating, doing paintings for several of the ladies' magazines before the war. At the end of the war, he'd lost his ability to paint. World War II. He had actually, very factually, neglected to confront any canvas for so long that he couldn't confront any canvas. You get the idea? Now, what was the total solution to this boy's painting skill? Canvas. I remember the Dumas brothers, quite interesting as writers. One of the younger Dumas was in a high state of revolt. He wasn't going to turn out that many words. And they used to put him in his room. The older ones, put him in his room. And when he slid so many manuscript pages out under the door, they slid something to eat in. You say, that's cruelty. How could that man ever have become a writer? Well, he not only became a writer, he did wonderfully well. There's where we sometimes seem to feel that cross, mean, or vicious methods have a workability, and we make a mistake. We believe that the viciousness, the meanness, and the threat of punishment is what is getting a result. That isn't what's getting a result. Demanding that somebody confront something gets a result. Punishment to restrain somebody from doing something never did otherwise than worsen that person. To restrain a person by threat of punishment from action will inevitably worsen that person. Oddly enough, it's true. Slow him down because it takes his awareness away. It reduces his ability to confront life. How about the other way around? How about punishment, threats, and duress to make him confront something? Unfortunately, works. And those of us who have had a great deal to do with the world of men and the world of duress know that it works. And we very often fall into the fallacy of believing then that punishment works. Once in a while, I've had an expedition crew. The weather was so bad, and everybody was so dug in and exhausted. that they didn't care whether the ship went down or not. And I've had to get about 14 feet tall with a double fist in each hand and a good heavy pair of sea boots to get anybody to man pumps, lines, or do anything else. Come out of an adventure like that, ship still afloat, you did make them get out of their bunk, you did make them pick themselves up off the decks. Exhaust or no exhaustion, do something. You come out of that, you're liable to pick up a new philosophy. You're liable to pick up the philosophy, punishment's the thing. You see how that could be an error? You're liable to say, well, then punishment's the thing, we'll restrain this fellow with punishment, and then he'll become a better person. Do you see that basic error? It's not true at all. It was regrettable that you had to use punishment to make anybody confront something. But having accomplished the confronting this, one way or the other, very often you were able to pick up the person's ability, and he could carry on. Therefore, a soft-headed attitude toward the younger generation would be, well, life is pretty mean and life is pretty cruel, and we will protect them, and we will teach them not to confront things for their own good. There was one town that practiced safety in England and never had a single automobile casualty with a child, although it was on a main highway. Well, there were other towns that were teaching safety all the time. Don't confront, don't confront. And they were having lots of casualties. What was the difference? Actually, this town almost accidentally was making all of its children confront traffic. It made them familiar with traffic. It had them out there touching traffic and monkeying with traffic and fooling with traffic. It didn't tell them, don't walk on the roads. It said, walk on the roads this way. And then made them walk on the roads that way. Other places, they just tell the child, keep away from traffic, keep away from traffic, keep away from traffic. One fine day, we put him behind the wheel and he has a wreck. Why? He can't confront an automobile. That's all there is to it. It's too bad that in training, we can't have somebody have a few wrecks. If you had a machine that gave him a few crashes and casualties and so forth, you say, well, this will train him not to confront things. Well, it would only train him if those synthetic crashes and casualties hurt him. Actually, the main thing about a crash or casualty is it scares somebody half to death. And he's in such a state of shock that he holds on to the somatic, and so he gets hurt. Look at that as a reverse view. Supposing you had an automobile wheel and so forth, and it drove along, and if you did so and so, it would suddenly swerve off the road and crash into a wall. Padded, see? Crash, thud, windows all break, everything goes to pieces, and so forth. You tell him, get out of there now and straighten up the glass and so forth, and put some new panels in, put him back in again. It apparently drives down the road with a screen or something of the sort and runs off into a ditch, crash. See? You make him get out of there and patch it up. And I'm afraid you'd wind up with the best race driver in the world. And oddly enough, one day somebody would hook his wheel and pull him sideways on a turn, and he would go splintering into a telegraph pole, and he would get up out of the car and brush the busted glass and so forth off of him and wonder why the other guy was lying there dead. Because you see, a Thetan doesn't have any excuse to die anyhow. It's just on an agreement. A body would recover from anything if a Thetan wasn't trying to make it and everything connected with it survive. Remember that. The greatest little survivors you ever saw are Thetans. They're nutty on the subject. Insane on the subject. They can't do anything else. They can pretend to go unconscious and then wake up a few years later and say, oh, I was just born again. I've just been created. It's an interesting game, but it's not the truth. Do you realize that that chair under you at this moment collapsed, crash, And you set it back up again and sat down in it. Nothing really happened to the chair, you see. It just collapsed, bang. You put its legs back on, patched up, you sat down in it. You know something? The action of the chair collapsing is not continuing. It is something that has happened. Let me point that out to you. It happened. It doesn't continue in the physical universe. The only thing which makes it continue is you. You are the only being that has any power of continuance of anything. And if you hurt yourself as the chair collapsed, the only reason the somatic would continue, as we know by Dianetic processing, since we rub these pictures out, is because you were keeping a picture of the entire incident in continuance, and you have made that accident continue from now till eternity. But the messed universe didn't make it continue. You did. Why did you make it continue? Because you didn't have enough things to confront. You said, look at this nice, juicy accident. I can't have it, but I can have it, but I'll make it continue. So you stack these things up. They become precious. How would you get them unstacked? How would you get rid of them? Make enough of them. There's an auditing man that goes with this. Simply this. It's simply this. No further ramifications to it beyond starting a session and so forth. You say to the preclear, mock up something to confront. That's all you say. Mock up something more to confront. Mock up something more to confront. Mock up something more to confront. First he will say, oh no, I get it, but you know it's not real, of course. After a while, they'll get realer and realer. At first he'll tell you, I don't want to have any of those things. I don't want to really confront any of those things. I couldn't really confront any of these things in real life. And after a while, he goes right over the hump and wonderful. Slurp, slurp, slurp. The reason people get stuck on being cause is not because they want to be cause, but because they found out they had to be if they were going to get anything happening. You want to get something going, you better make it happen, because nothing else is going to make it happen. Everything's dead around here. One horse town. If you're going to burn it down, you'll have to burn it down. Messed universe too stable, it's not accommodating. You see how this could occur? You see what could pursue from that? So, walk up something to confront. Now, of course, you have your trio of havingness, you've got other things. You can tell somebody to look around and find something you could waste. Look around and find something you'd waste. You could say, look around and find a substitute for mother. Mother isn't present, but the messed universe is, so you find a substitute for mother. You say that often enough, you get rid of that valence. Look around here and find a substitute for father. Look around here and find a substitute for your wife. Look around here and find something that would waste your wife. You can operate on any part of this scale, you see. You'll find out pretty soon that the fellow starts to run the scale itself. And you've finally got him up to a point where he can mock up things to confront, and his mock-ups are very, very brilliant. The quick method I told you about the first day of this Congress doesn't stand or hold because he's not willing to confront it. You have just manhandled him into turning on his mock-ups that bright. He doesn't like it. Why doesn't he like it? Because he doesn't want to confront it. Because he can't confront it, he feels. Why can't he confront it? Because he doesn't have many of them. If he gave him a few more, he could confront it. That's all there is to it. The reason people don't like accidents, they don't have many. Sounds silly, but it's true. The reason bodies don't recover from illnesses is because they're seldom sick. All right. Some people spend a whole lifetime trying to remedy their having this of sicknesses to confront. All right, we look over this picture of confrontingness and we find out it is a quantitative thing. A person feels that he should have more, he feels he cannot confront things because he doesn't have enough things to confront. You make him remedy this one way or the other, and his interest in life, his ability to handle and control his body, oddly enough, picks way right on up. Why does it pick up? Well, if he can make his body, if there are things to confront, enough of them, then he can make his body confront things, and if he can make his body confront things, then he can control it. Well, it's actually not very complicated. There are various things you can do with bodies. There's a limited technique, mock up your body and make it confront the wall. Why doesn't it work? Well, maybe the fellow can't make his body confront the wall, and it's too much of a strain. So we very often find that we run a confrontingness process, mock up something in front, mock up something in front. We find out somebody's havingness goes down. Why would his havingness go down? Well, it's because confronting things gives him space, and that gets into his havingness, and he doesn't like it. He's being overstrained. So very often you find with a case that you have to cut in with a trio. You have to say, look around and find something that you could have. On and on and on. But if that didn't work, you could say, look around and find something you could waste. Look around and find a substitute for something you could have. That would be the technique, and that is the scale, and that is the score. What do you think? Well, we've actually had a very wonderful Congress here so far. I've enjoyed very much talking to you. I'm very flattered that you came. I hope anything I have had to tell you or anything that we could do for you here was of use to you. You've been a very, very, very fine audience. I hope to see a lot more of you. But particularly, I think you've already done an awful lot for Scientology. And I want to thank you for that right here and now. May I? Thank you. I hope to see you all again at the June Congress. And in the meantime, I wish you the best of luck. And I'll be in there pitching. Hope you'll be in there pitching. Maybe we'll make a world out of it after all. Thank you very much. Thank you.